is a formulation of the BKL conjecture in Ashtakar variables, which I'm putting under the title of Strong Gravity and the BKL conjecture. This is work that has been done with Adam Henderson and Abhay Ashtakar here at Penn State. So let's move on to the first slide, which will be the contents. Okay, so here we have the introduction, the outline itself. First, I'm going to tell you a little bit about the BKL conjecture itself and what it's going to mean for us, how other people have interpreted it, and what people are thinking about it at the moment. Then move on and talk about Ashtakar variables and what things look like there, and why they're relevant and what we're going to use them for. Then move on and tell you a little bit about the Kasner singularity, which is a motivating factor in all everything we're doing here. After that, I'll move on to a toy model, which is that is the idea of strong gravity, the strong coupling limit of gravity, and tell you why that relates to the work we're doing, and sort of run through finding constraints, equations of motion, the way we solve this toy model. After that, I'll tell you about a more real, more physically motivated model, tell you about the, sort of the reasons we use it and the calculus and everything we had to go through to make this work, give you a quick example of it, and talk about making the BKL reduction. And then finally, I'll give a summary, some conclusions, and the references for the work I've done. Okay, so let's move on to the next slide, which should be titled The Conjecture. By the way, if people have questions, please feel free to stop me at any time, and I'll also try and pause for a while at the end of each section to give you a chance to ask any questions you have. Can everybody hear this? Okay. So, the BKL conjecture is an idea that was put forward by Belinsky, Kolasnikov, and Lipschitz at the, in the late 60s and early 70s. The idea is that near to a singularity, spatially separated points decouple, and the role of most forms of matter is negligible. Now, this was first put forward, as I said, in the early 70s, really, and initially, people didn't really pay too much attention to it. The reason for this is that it has quite a number of problems. First off, it doesn't appear to be geometric. That is, what do we really mean by separation between points? That seems to change when we change our slicing or we change our metric, we change our coordinates, for example. Also, the mathematical implications of this are fairly vague. What do we really mean by spatially separated points decoupling? People have interpreted this in different ways. Some people say it means you can ignore spatial derivatives. Other people say no, that they just become negligible compared to certain other values. The numerical guys would like to say that spatial derivatives get suppressed and it's only spatial derivatives of certain different tensors that you can actually ignore. And so the mathematical implications, they aren't particularly well founded. And finally, this is only a conjecture. There is no analytic proof of this statement yet. People like Alan Rendall have sort of managed to form proofs of certain aspects of this within, say, a stiff fluid or scalar field. What we call a scalar field, he called a stiff fluid. Within that framework, they've managed to prove that some of this is correct, but as of yet, there is no analytic proof of the BKL conjecture itself. Okay, so why did people start taking this more seriously, and what is the motivation for us applying this conjecture today? Well, first off, the Einstein field equations are very difficult to solve, as we all know. Finding general solutions to the Einstein equations, finding any solutions at all, generally takes a very long time. And so what we aim to do is something very much akin to what is done in cosmology, or in, say, when you find the Schwarzschild solution. What we're going to do is make a simplification. We're going to make an ansatz that space-time is either homogeneous or isotropic or some other symmetry reduction, and try and solve general relativity in that case. Now, what we want to do is we want to say, okay, there is a simplification in the form of the BKL reduction, and we want to solve the field equations in that case. However, this sort of relates to things that we were told about a few weeks ago by Johannes Tamburino, who was looking at sort of homogeneous cosmologies and making perturbations to those. Also, another motivator is that recently we found a lot of numerical work that can support this conjecture. People like David Garfinkel, Clyde Zoegler, and a whole bunch of others I've listed here, and there are many, many more, have been doing numerical simulations which seem to provide support for the BKL conjecture. People have been simulating what they call generic spacetimes. Other people have simulated Gaudi models and various other ideas, and they have found that there is, by and large, quite a large amount of numerical evidence for this BKL conjecture.
I have a question.
Yes.
This is Laurent from Turner.
Okay.
And it's related to your first story. I'm a bit confused by what this BKL conjecture means, because when you say that, you know, numerical evidence supports that, because presumably it depends on which slicing you use, what is your notion of time,
yes,
what is your notion of space. So, yeah, what is, I mean, before even proving it or before having the status of a conjecture, they should be well-defined. Is there at least a well-defined conjecture? What really that means?
There is to an extent, and it's a little bit strange to tell you this, but the BKL conjecture, it's interpreted in different ways by different groups at the moment. And so I will tell you what our interpretation is a little later on in this talk. But for example, Alan Rendell talks about the idea that if you take a spatial derivative of a function, say, or a tensor, and divide it by that tensor, this should be well bounded near a singularity.
But doesn't that depend on your choice of coordinates?
Yes, it does. So what generally happens with the numerical guys is they do a constant mean curvature slicing, or they do an inverse curvature flow, and they work from there. And they say that within this slicing, you can see that this is true. But yes, you're absolutely right. This does seem to be slicing dependent.
Okay.
Any more clarifications? Okay, so let's move on to the next slide, which should be Ashley-Carr variables. So another thing we have to motivate is, why are we going to do this in Ashley-Carr variables? Or kind of equivalently, why am I telling the international loop quantum gravity community about this idea? Well, the reason we use Ashley-Carr variables, and this isn't just yet another BKL formulation, is that Ashley-Carr variables allow us a very simple formulation of general relativity. Okay? We work with the basic variables of a triad and a connection, and we don't need their inverses when we form things like constraints and equations of motion in general. This compares to, well to, say, the ADM variables, where we both need a 3-metric and its inverse when we want to define equations of motion, and the active inversion itself is not well defined at a singularity. Also, these variables form our candidates for a quantum theory of gravity. Loop quantum gravity itself is based on these variables. Now, once again, the fact that there are no inverses required is absolutely key when we approach a singularity. If you're going to have a quantum operator and want to form its inverse, the spectrum of the inverse when we approach a singularity relates to the spectrum of the operator itself. This relationship actually seems to break down, and so actually finding a quantum theory of gravity, we would like to have this situation where we don't have to use the inverses of certain variables. And finally, in loop quantum gravity, we see singularity resolution, and I will tell you a little bit more about that after a quick caveat. And the caveat is that what we have done here is work in self-dual variables. Now, the self-dual variables themselves don't form this candidate for quantum theory. What we really need to do is reevaluate what we've done in real variables, and this is work to come. We think that we should be able to sort of run through and change over to real variables without too much of a problem, but sort of to make the simplifications we have made, some of them require that we work in self-dual variables. Okay, so let me tell you a little bit about singularity resolution. So this is by and large our goal. This is a sort of a, it's quite a lofty goal, but the idea is that what we would like to do is find that we can resolve a large class of cosmological singularities. So the aim here is that we will examine these cosmological singularities, and by and large everything I will talk to you about today is a cosmological singularity. And we will attempt to resolve this. Now, in loop quantum gravity, we've been seeing recently, we're in a very exciting phase where we've seen that sort of some cosmological singularities, and indeed the black hole singularities, have been resolved. This is work that's been done by Abai, Martin, Dawei Chu, Kevin van der Sloot, Alejandro Corici, and all kinds of other people. I seem to have quite a bias towards naming people here at Penn State, but that's just the work I know quite well. But we are in a very similar position to when singularities were first found in general relativity. Initially, you know, the Schwarzschild singularity was found, and if you do the FRW models, you find a singularity. And there was a great deal of debate about whether singularities were just an artifact of the coordinate system you were using or some of the assumptions you were making, whether saying homogeneity and isotropy, you know, this should break down as we approach a singularity and we shouldn't have one at all. And initially, there was this great deal of debate over whether or not singularities actually existed within general relativity, or whether they were just a strange phenomenon arising from the coordinates we use. Likewise, singularity resolution in loop quantum gravity is at a very similar place. We see that, okay, we have resolved certain singularities, but we've had to make these sort of ansatzes of saying we're in a homogeneous and isotropic case, while we work in loop quantum cosmology, and we say, okay, we're going to have you know, complete homogeneity and isotropy and just quantize these two variables, C and P. And so we are kind of at that phase now, and sort of, as everyone knows, the story gets a lot better in the proof that singularities exist in general relativity. Hawking and Penrose came along and proved these singularity theorems that tells us generally that, no, under most generic conditions, there is a singularity in general relativity. I should say the Hawking-Penrose theorems are a perfect piece of mathematics in that they tell you that a singularity exists and absolutely nothing else about it. They're sort of mathematics that physicists love and hate. So what we would like to do is sort of prove sort of an almost an analog to these theorems, and this is a huge goal to go for, I admit, but we would like to sort of be able to say that we can make some reductions by this BKL conjecture and prove, therefore, hopefully, I mean, and this isn't something we've done yet, but this is the goal, and prove that in loop quantum gravity, in general, these cosmological singularities are resolved. Okay, so next slide, please. Okay, the next slide is a brief recap of Aksakov variables with units involved. I'm going to put units back into these variables because this is going to be very helpful when we do the strong coupling limit. In fact, just using these units in almost a numerology type way is going to tell us what the strong coupling limit of this theory is. And so I've listed the triad and connection and its relations with the ADM variables. And also, from setting the units of the triad to be 1, we find the units of the connection M over LT. Now, this is just from saying that, okay, the units of the Poisson bracket should be h bar times a delta function, and from that you sort of track back to get the units of A. This is all fairly simple.
I have a question.
Yep.
In the first equation, is that a square root of Q, or is it going to be Q?
Where are we in the first equation? Sorry. That should be a Q, actually, I think, right? Yeah, I'm sorry, that's a typo. That should be a Q. That's a typo, yes. Okay, any more typos anyone spotted?
Well, there should be a square root of 3.
I'm sorry?
There should be a square root of Q in 3.
In 3, yes. That's right. I got the 2 the wrong way around. I was correcting this the other night, and I obviously missed that. Thank you. Okay, so let's move on to the next slide before anyone else thought that I don't know what I'm doing. And we'll talk about the Kasner singularity. The Kasner singularity is a motivating factor for this research. The reason being that it's sort of the solution to the homogeneous and anisotropic cosmology formed by the Bianchi-1 model. Now, this is, okay, it's obviously not a general solution, but it's a nice motivator. If you can sort of cope with the Kasner singularity, you can sort of read off from your behavior the way in which certain variables behave as you approach a singularity. Obviously, this isn't going to give you the full information, but this is sort of a nice starting point. So the Kasner singularity takes the form given by equation 7. Ds squared is minus d tau squared plus tau to some powers dx squared plus dy squared plus dz squared. Now we have a couple of constraints on these powers. First off, they sum to 1, and their squares sum to 1. Okay? These are just the constraints. And these p's are all real numbers. Okay? So what we see here is that we have 1 degree of freedom, just by counting the number of things we have. 3 variables, 2 constraints implies 1 degree of freedom by some slightly non-dubious mathematics. These are homogeneous vacuum solutions to the Einstein equations, and they are unstable in perturbations. Now, what do I mean by that? Well, if you want to go back and do, say, your constant mean curvature slicing, and make and say, okay, we can sort of have slices that obey this Kasner singularity that are perfectly well defined by this, and we can make small inhomogeneous perturbations to these and involve those in time, you find that these perturbations actually grow linearly. In fact, they grow faster than linearly in some cases. And so this is unstable in perturbations. Okay? The reason for that basically boils down to the fact that our two constraints imply that one of these p numbers is less than 0. And that is, seems to be what drives the instability. Talking to David Garfinkel, he told us rather a lot about this the other day, and it turns out that if you can arrange things by adding a scalar field, which is called a stiff fluid in the numerical papers, it actually gives rise to a stable sector. That's because these constraints get broken by adding a scalar field. If you add a scalar field, instead of the squared summing to 1, you get an extra factor of p phi squared, the conjugate momentum to the scalar field. And so this actually allows you to say that in some cases, all these p's are positive, and that forms a stable sector of the theory. Okay, so that ends the introduction section. Are there any questions at this stage? Okay, the silence means I'll move on. So now I want to tell you about a toy model that we've been working with in the form of strong gravity. And I cannot stress enough that this is a toy model. This is not particularly physically motivated, and this is probably isn't really a good example of what's being done. But it's a nice toy model in that we can run through finding constraints, finding equations of motion, and basically testing out our ability to make a reduction to equations by doing this. Okay, so what we're going to do is examine the strong coupling limit, that is taking a large value of Newton's constant, while keeping our triad and connection fixed. The motivation for this is to consider a covariant derivative. If you think about a covariant derivative and you write it out, you get a partial derivative plus a connection term. And simply by looking back and reading off the units, you find that there's a factor of g over c in front of the connection term. Okay? From this, we can say in a very hand-wavy way that ignoring these spatial derivatives is equivalent to taking a large value of the Newton constant. And so the strong coupling limit of gravity forms a toy model for the BKL conjecture. We ignore spatial derivatives. Okay? If you think about this as well, if you look at this equation, taking a large value of g is kind of like taking a very small value of the speed of light c. If you draw this out, you find that your light cones begin to contract on themselves, and your light cone, the angle at which they form, kind of shrinks down. And that tells you, basically, that spatial points are decoupling. The spatial points that can influence a point lie within its past light cone. Well, this past light cone is closed up to just being a straight line. And so points have decoupled one from another. And hence you can see that this does form sort of a candidate for a toy model of the BKL conjecture. Now, obviously, this is not the entire picture, okay? In general, what we're going to see is that these spatial derivatives become suppressed by factors rather than just ignored. Indeed, just to say we're going to ignore spatial derivatives is a bit silly, because we could be ignoring the spatial derivative of something that blows up quite drastically, and so maybe its spatial derivative, even though it's smaller than the variable itself, may still blow up quite drastically. Yes?
Is that also depend on connection,
Yes, it depends on connection. The question is, does this depend on the connection? And the answer is yes, it does. It depends on the connection itself, but we are keeping the triad and connection fixed as we take this limit. And so what we see is that the connection is just some, we can imagine that, if you like, this connection is just some number. So this spatial derivative is small compared to the term with the connection in it.
Sorry. I have a question.
Yes.
As you mentioned here, the, you know, in the way you derive the limit, taking g to infinity or c to zero seems to be the same thing. But physically, we expect these things to be, you know, corresponding to different limits, keeping different sectors different. So, are you sure you're really taking the g infinity limit and not the other one? The other one would be c to zero. So clearly, space Lipon would decouple, but I would expect these two limits to be different.
Laura, if you look at all the field equations, then in fact you see that the two limits are exactly the same. This was kind of done in the late 80s. It is a surprising thing, but it's true that you cannot.
Yeah, but the question is why should I keep fixed? Because you know, it might be that at the same time, if I send g to infinity, I have to send a to zero, or, you know, the other way around. So,
statement is that you declare the rules of the game, namely that e and a are fixed.
Yeah.
And
because
certain things happen.
Okay. Because in the 80s, there was who was this guy, Pirani or
no? Pilati had written a paper. And it is true that the strong coupling limit in the AEM variable is not the same as the strong coupling limit in the connection variable. Besides, what you keep fixed is the important thing.
Yes, because here you're keeping fixed the spin connection is equal to the explicit curvature. And when you get A fixed, so it's not the same, exactly the same.
Yeah, exactly. So the physics of the two things are different. And it, actually, in the AEM variable, is much less clear as to what exactly the limit is. We can talk about it later if you want.
Okay.
And is it consistent with the field equation to keep A and E fixed?
We're about to see on the next slide. So let's move to the next slide. And what we see here is if we write out the full constraints in these in the Ashtakov variables, we just can read off what the scalar constraint, vector constraint, and Gauss constraint are in the strong coupling limits. We just look at the equations, and we see that on the left-hand side, we have a lot of spatial derivatives, and on the right-hand side, we have factors of Newton's constant multiplied by some variables which I've declared that we're keeping fixed. Okay? And so we can do this strong gravity reduction quite simply and read off just what the scalar, vector, and Gauss constraints are. And in fact, what you find is that they are, well, the equations given below, the scalar constraint looks like e squared a squared. The vector constraint and the Gauss constraint are proportional to one another. The vector constraint is just the Gauss constraint contracted with a connection. Okay? And we can form the Poisson brackets between these constraints, and we find sort of a nice check. You know, if it didn't work, we'd know our theory was definitely wrong. But as a nice check, we find that on the constraint surface defined by these constraints, these Poisson brackets are zero. Okay, so let's move on to the next slide. Okay. So now what I want to do is introduce a new variable, M. And although this may seem a little confusing at first, the reason I do this is because it simplifies things greatly. So we're going to form this variable M, and I hold my hands up, there's absolutely no motivation for calling it M, and I certainly wouldn't want anyone to call this an M theory. But we introduce this new variable M by taking a contraction of our triad with our connection on internal indices. This gives us a tensor which just has two internal indices, and sort of the reasons for doing this are that it simplifies the theory greatly. We have a tensor with just internal indices, so when we do simulations or anything, we can just think of this as being a matrix. And I've written down what the Poisson brackets between M and itself and E and M are. And finally, there's constraints written in terms of M. You can see why this simplifies the theory. The scalar constraint just becomes the trace of M squared minus the trace of M squared, and the Gauss constraint tells us that this M is symmetric. Okay? So the reasons for writing this M down are that it simplifies the constraints. I mean, we have constraints just in terms of one variable now, and it sort of seems to simplify the theory greatly. Okay? So let's move on to the next slide, which should be titled Equations of Motion. So we can solve our theory, we can solve our equations of motion by just taking Poisson brackets of the Hamiltonian constraint formed from the scalar constraint with the variables themselves to find their time derivatives. And so what we find is that the time derivative of E goes like the trace of M times the delta function, subtract M itself times the original variable, and the time derivative of M is zero. Now, initially, if you form these equations, you find that the time derivative of M actually has some symmetric part of M multiplied by the anti-symmetric part, and so we have to apply the Gauss constraint to tell us that this M dot equals zero. And then, below that, I have a little commutative diagram to show that what we're doing is somewhat valid. So if you take the full constraints, find equations of motion, and then take the large gravity limit, you get reduced equations of motion. If you take the full constraints, take the large gravity limit there, and find the reduced constraints, then find equations of motion from there, you get the exact same equations. And so this tells us to an extent that what we are doing is well defined. We can go either way around this diagram and get to the same point, which is kind of a nice check that what we're doing, we haven't really broken any rules so far in taking the limit, or we haven't contradicted ourselves, I guess. Okay, so let's move on to the next slide. Now, because we've been working in self-dual variables, we're going to have to apply reality conditions. And so we want the three metric to be real, which means its time derivative is real, which means that this M matrix must be purely imaginary, or I times this M must be real. Since IM is a symmetric and real matrix, so we apply the Gauss constraint here to say it's symmetric, we can diagonalize it. Okay? This is one of the great things about forming this M as an internal, a purely internal tensor. We can just say, okay, we can pick a basis for our internal space and turn this into a diagonal matrix. And hence, you can solve your equations quite easily. And what we see is that the solutions form something that looks a lot like the Kasner singularity I was telling you about originally. You've got dx squared is minus d tau squared plus tau to some power is dx squared dy squared dz squared. These e zeros that's been written in here just arise from the initial slice that you give me. And these powers now are no longer just real numbers, but these are functions on space. So they are functions of x, y, and z, and they satisfy the constraint that they sum to 1 at each spatial point, and their squares sum to 1 at each spatial point. And so what we have here isn't quite a Kasner singularity, but it's like you can think of it as being a Kasner spacetime at each spatial point. Okay? Now, this is something you should almost actually have expected from the conditions I set originally. I originally said we're going to ignore spatial derivatives, and so things should be approximately homogeneous. I mean, this is a little hand-wavy, but approximately you would expect homogeneity from this, and so you would expect to get something like a Bianchi 1 solution. However, we've only said that spatial points decouple. We haven't said that they're all completely homogeneous, which is why we seem to be getting a different Bianchi 1 spacetime at each spatial point.
Sorry, E0 depends on space. Points
too. E0 depends on spatial points too, yes. I'm sorry, I didn't say that explicitly, yes. Okay, and so that is the end of the toy model. What I can tell you about this relates to the numerical methods that have been done, the numerical simulations that have been done by people like David Garfinkel and so on, And this represents actually a sector of the results they get from the BKL conjecture as they apply it. It's not the full thing. In general, this doesn't have any mixed master behavior, which is seen in the numerical simulations. And there's a reason for that. In applying our reality conditions and saying that M is symmetric, but mainly actually coming from the reality conditions, we have said that there is zero spatial curvature in this model. Okay? If you just look at the self-dual variables, you find that A is gamma plus IK. We said that the imaginary part, the real part of A is zero, effectively. And so we have ignored spatial curvature. And it turns out that spatial curvature actually drives the bounces that we see in the mixed master behavior. And if you want to know more about that, the papers by Garfinkel kind of explain what's going on there. So what we have here is a sort of model, a toy model, which has given us a sector of the full theory that we would hope to observe.
I have a question.
Yeah.
So to the early solution, you neglect the derivative of E, for instance. But at the end, the solution, the E could be any random function. So the question is, what type of condition on E and F do you get so that you're consistent with your initial assumption? That is, that the E is smaller than AE or something like that. So can you compute AE and DE and compare them and see when the solution is in fact really satisfying your hypothesis?
Well, we can, and what would happen is that you'd find that this E0, for example, would have to be homogeneous for DAE to be 0. I mean, that's just sort of a first off. But
that would to be much smaller than AE. So A is big as, you wrote only the metric, but the is it easy to write down the condition on AE?
Right. That's true. You would have to write that the condition on AE. However, what we've done here is we've formed this toy model, and this toy model is totally non-physical. I mean, I've ignored all spatial derivatives, which is, you know, completely unfair. You know, it's not really very physical to just ignore all spatial derivatives. And basically what you'd come up with is that spatial derivatives of F and E are negligible. Okay? But
it should be negligible in front of A. So I'm worried about the fact that A might be 0, for instance, but it may be not the case.
Oh, the spin connection A? No, it's not the case.
Because A has also explicit curvature, which is really a time derivative. And
okay,
that's another one.
Yeah, but there's a difference with the spin connection, so it doesn't, okay.
Okay, are there any more questions? Because this is the end of the toy model, and I'll move on to the real model afterwards. Okay, so next slide, we're going to deal with the real model. So this should be the slide titled, A New Calculus. So here what I'm going to do is define a new calculus, a way of deciding what terms we're going to neglect in order to come up with a much more physical model for this BKL limit. Okay? So we're going to examine the following scenario. We're going to say that instead of a spatial derivative being 0, we're going to contract a triad with a spatial derivative and say that when that acts on certain objects, we get 0. So these objects are tensors where the square root of determinant q times the tensor has a limit as we approach the singularity. Okay? This seems a little bit complicated, and it is, but we really need this type of square root net q times the tensor having to be bounded at our singularity in order to allow us a large enough class of spacetimes to actually be considering real singularities. Okay? We're going to say, and this is just the rules of the game, we're going to say that the triad and the connection are members of the set, and we're going to define our singularity to be where the determinant of the 3 metric goes to 0. Now, the more geometrically minded of you out there should be jumping all over me for this statement, because obviously we can have the determinant of a 3 metric go to 0 and not be at a singularity. And in fact, later on, in fact, in the next slide I'll come to in a moment, I'll give you a perfect example of this. It's space-time where we've picked coordinates so that the determinant of the three metric vanishes on a slice, but we are nowhere near a singularity. Okay? However, we do allow us, ourselves, to examine singularities in which the determinant goes to zero. Now, this is motivated from cosmology. We're thinking about a Big Bang type of scenario where, you know, the three metric all shrinks up to a point. And so it kind of makes sense that we do consider this deck Q goes to zero. Okay. The other thing we can say about this is if you form a Weyl invariant by contracting two Weyl tensors, one with another, this will blow up like Q to the minus 4. If this blows up like Q to the minus 4 or Q to the minus 3 or lesser powers, we can cope with this scenario. This would fit with our A and E would fit within our set there. Okay? And finally, I'm going to make this one unreasonable assumption. The unreasonable assumption is that the spatial curvature is negligible. I'm going to set it to zero. Now, this was pointed out to us just last week by David Garfinkel, that in fact this is a very unreasonable assumption for precisely the reason that these gammas drive the mixmaster behavior. They drive the bounces that we see in numerical simulations. However, between bounces, we do see zero spatial curvature in simulations. And given that between a solar radius and a Planck length, when we see a contraction, we generally see around three or four bounces, we can say that, okay, what we're considering is the space after the final bounce and just before quantum effects start to take place. And so, yes, I mean, I hold my hands up. We haven't included spatial curvature, and this is definitely work to do in the future. But we can say that there is sort of a reasonable, this is an unreasonable assumption, but there is a reason for actually using it. So it's a reasoned, unreasonable assumption, I guess. So let's talk about why we're going to use this model. Why are we going to apply this calculus? Well, first off, this is very similar to the work done by Ugler, Elst, and I think Wainwright also was in on this, where they considered almost Friedman-Lemaître models. So what they did was they took homogeneous and isotropic models, and they made perturbations to them and simulated this. What they worked with were Hubble normalized variables, so they divided out by the Hubble constant at all times. What we are doing is we're multiplying variables, or we're saying multiples of the square root of the determinant of the three metric times a variable is what's going to play the role of their Hubble parameter for us. This is kind of a little bit nicer than what they do when you want to consider a quantum theory, because dividing by variables in general is a pretty bad thing when you want to form a quantum theory. There is a lot of numerical evidence for this, particularly coming from David Garfinkel, but also I think Berger and Moncrief and a few other people have done simulations that tend to support this type of conjecture, this type of model. And a concrete example of this is the Gaudi model. Now, in the Gaudi model, what you do is you say that space is a three torus on which we're going to have 2 degrees of symmetry, and so we're going to have an inhomogeneous and anisotropic model, but in one dimension on this torus. And what we see there is that if you solve the Einstein field equations, you find a singularity, and you pick coordinates nicely, so the singularity is as t goes to infinity. And we see that wherever there is a spatial derivative of some quantity, it has an e to the minus t factor in front of it. So it's precisely this behavior where spatial derivatives themselves aren't ignored, but they are being suppressed by some factor, okay? And that arises in the Gaudi model. Also, only numerical evidence for this so far, but in what has been called generic spacetimes by some of the numerical simulators, they seem to be indicating that a similar behavior happens. However, it's not entirely clear what they're seeing. What they do is, again, they work with a constant mean curvature slicing. And if you think about it, what we're going to work with could be somewhat akin to a constant mean curvature slicing. if you fix a mean curvature, if you give me a constant mean curvature slice, I can pick a set of coordinates so that at least locally the determinant of my free metric is a constant. And so evolving from one slice on which the determinant of the free metric is constant to another is exactly the same as following a constant mean curvature flow. Okay? So what we're going to do is very much akin to what's done by the numerical people. Sorry, is there a question? Okay, well, I don't hear any questions, so if there is, please yell at me. Also, okay, our model allows for this spatial derivative of some tensor divided by that tensor in some way of forming a size of this to be bounded. This is the behavior that Randall talks about, and this is the behavior that you see in, say, a Maxwell theory and other sort of more classical theories as we approach a singularity. Finally, we just see from the Kasner model that we introduced at the start, it's just the fact that E and A and hence M are in this set that I've said are negligible. It's just the way that things behave in the Kasner model. Okay, so let's move on to the next slide, which should be an example. So let us consider now a non-singular example of this. If you form Minkowski space in coordinates adapted to a hyperboloid, you find a metric E squared is minus P rho squared plus rho squared times the metric on a unit hyperboloid. Okay? And here we see taking rho to zero is just like taking the determinant of the three metric to zero. I mean, you can just read this off straight away. And so I've drawn a little picture under here, and I've drawn a line on it in red. We can consider approaching the determinant of the three metric going to zero as being moving along this red line out towards a light cone defined by rho equals zero. Okay? However, we know full well that this is actually non-singular here. I mean, we're just in Minkowski space, and Minkowski space is probably the least singular space anyone will ever see. So what's going on? Well, the determinant of the three metric is going to zero, but we're not at a singularity, we're just at a regular point. It's just a coordinate singularity that's happening here, okay? And that happens within our model too. We can have coordinate singularities, and so our model had better be able to cope with simple coordinate singularities. And to cut a long story short, it does. If you go through the analysis, you find that coordinate singularities are perfectly fine within our model. Okay, so next slide, which is the full theory, so the non-reduced constraints and equations of motion. So let's look at the constraints in Ashtakov variables. Well, they're exactly the same as what was written down earlier for the toy model. We have these full constraints. And what we're going to do is add a multiple of the Gauss constraint to our Hamiltonian to keep our evolution of our triad real. This is just a standard trick. This is a Lagrange multiplier in front of the Gauss constraint. And basically what this does is it ensures that E continues to be real if we set it to be real at some time. Now below this I've written down the full equations of motion. So I've made no reduction yet. I've written down the equations of motion for E and M. And the equation of motion for M you'll see involves E, A, and M itself. Obviously only two of these are independent variables. And the reason I sort of included A in here instead of going across to M in all cases was that it saved me having to write out 20 lines of code. Okay? So next slide, please, which should be the BKL reduction. So we get the reduced equations of motion. And here what we see is the Gauss constraint tells us that the purely complex part now of this matrix M is zero. It's symmetric. Purely imaginary part, I should say, not purely complex, that makes no sense. The purely imaginary part of this matrix M is symmetric, and we then see that we get the same equations of motion for E and M that we had in the toy model. So we're going to get exactly the same set of solutions, these generalized Kasner-looking solutions. Okay? Now, again, there's a reason for this. This is because we've ignored spatial curvature. And I'll tell you a little bit about that in a moment. But what it looks like is that the full equations of motion, this full VKL reduction, is giving us something very much akin to what we saw in the toy model. Okay? And finally, I've got another commutativity diagram here. What we see is if you take the full constraints and do a VKL reduction, you get reduced constraints and find equations of motion, you get these reduced equations of motion. And we can go around this the other way. We can find the full equations of motion and do this VKL reduction on those. And so this is a fairly well-defined, at least in my opinion, it's a fairly well-defined theory. Okay. All right, so finally, let's move on to the last slide in this section, which is about reintroducing spatial curvature.
Now, so I have a question. Yeah. I have a question about the evolutions. I mean, you have to check that the evolutions keep your conditions that the space slice or flat is conserved in time. Otherwise, it's not really consistent.
Yes. Well, if you do start off with a flat slice, you will see that it is conserved in time. But if you make small perturbations to this, they grow. And so this is not particularly stable. And that's exactly why you see these spikes in the mixed master behavior.
Okay.
Okay. So let's talk about reintroducing this spatial curvature. And this is very recent work, and it isn't at all fixed or finalized yet. So this is the one slide, well, one of many slides, but the slide you should take with a pinch of salt. First off, we can relax this zero spatial curvature condition. What this does is it tells you that we can no longer say that N is a symmetric matrix. We've reintroduced spatial curvature. M is formed from gamma plus IK, and so we can no longer do this symmetric reduction. What happens now is you get an equation of motion for M, which involves M itself and its antisymmetric part. And this is sort of the bane of my existence at the moment, because this is an incredibly simple-looking equation of motion. We have a 3x3 matrix that evolves as itself multiplied by its antisymmetric part. However, finding a general analytic solution to this is proving incredibly difficult. If you do the 2x2 case, you find that the solutions look like hyperbolic tangent on the diagonal and hyperbolic cosec off the diagonal. However, in a 3x3 case, we've done sort of very sort of ad hoc and very simple numerical simulations of this, we find this sort of amazingly unstable behavior. Things bounce. It appears, in fact, that we get something that looks very much like the bounce that's seen in numerical relativity happening. You know, values of M seem to suddenly peak and spike and drop back down and move up and down, almost seemingly at random. And so solving this equation actually might be beyond us. It might be something we have to do numerically because analytic solutions have not been forthcoming. And finally, if we make perturbations to this symmetric matrix, so this is your point, I think, if we make perturbations, these grow in time. Okay? And so obviously we can't just say that the symmetric part is stable. It isn't. It's an unstable sector, and this is work that we need to do. Okay, and so that forms the end of the real model, and let's move on to a summary. So the conclusions are that the BKL conjecture can be applied in Ashtar variables. Okay, this is very important because exactly, you know, the goal of our scheme is to end up with a quantum theory, and so what we're going to do is apply this BKL conjecture and then try and quantize the resulting simple theory, and we've shown that pretty much you can apply this BKL conjecture in Ashtar variables. The resulting space-time seems to have a Kasner singularity as the worst-case scenario. Obviously, you can get non-singular behavior out of this as well, as was shown by the little example. What happens there is that you say, instead of the leading order behavior of this matrix M is no longer just a constant, but it has some time-like behavior, it has some variation in time. It goes as some positive powers of time, and hence it is non-singular. And if you work through your equations from there, you can see that you can get non-singular solutions for this as well. Finally, we can say that this corresponds quite well to known numerical results. It corresponds to the known, although unstable, sector found by the numerical simulations. Now, there are a few open issues. Firstly, we've worked all the way through this in self-dual variables. really we should be working in the real variables. We don't expect too much to change on doing this, but it is definitely something that needs to be worked through if we're going to quantize. Secondly, and this is the big problem, is we need to add back in spatial curvature to get this bounce behavior. And finally, we need to add matter. What's always done when we're proving the singularity resolutions is that we add a scalar field. And so we really need to add a scalar field to our theory, and this is very much work in progress. Okay. And the final slide is just a set of references for what I've been talking about. And you can see there the references for Garfinkel, Rendell, and all the papers I've cited. And that's it. So thank you for listening.
Okay, so we have some time for questions, comments?
I have a question. Concerning the previous slide.
Okay.
So, now from your analysis, can you go back to the original question and do you claim that now you have in fact a well-defined formulation of what is the BKL conjecture in this in the Ashleigh-Carroll variable? Can you formulate it?
I would like to say I have a candidate for what is a formulation of the BKL conjecture. I won't say that this is the BKL conjecture because various other people will disagree with me. The numerical simulations will say, no, what you should be doing is Hubble normalizing, or you should be taking these variables and dividing by spatial derivatives by the variable itself. You shouldn't just be saying that these things lie within a certain set. So, no, I don't have a, I certainly would not claim I have a standard BKL conjecture that we can all agree on. But I do have what I'd like to say is a candidate in Ashleigh-Carroll variables.
Can you argue that it's more covariant?
Yes.
In many ways and...
Yes, I think it's much better adapted.
It's much better adapted for quantum theory, but it is really not covariant in the sense that you want to say, Laura. We still have to specify a foliation. And at the moment, I mean, one could use a foliation, which is just a constant mean curvature foliation, which is also what other people use in this game. In the spatially compact cases, this foliation, first of all, does exist. This has been proved a long time ago. Always exists. And secondly, there are these heuristic arguments which say that this foliation kind of goes and reaches the singularity, quote unquote, simultaneously. In other words, it's not that one point of this foliation reaches singularity and other points don't. This is a little bit of a matter of definition, but nonetheless, there is a whole industry called silent cosmology, which is based on those singularities which are reached by this kind of foliation. So, the statement is that it's not covariant, but it is, one can make it very geometrical, but the variables that are used are such that we can, where there is some hope of using it in quantum gravity, whereas the way that it is normally done, which is very extensive and a lot of analytic as well as numerical work, particularly by Ugala, George Ellis, John Wainwright, etc., that work is using variables which also actually trials and so on. But as David said, they divide out by the so-called the Hubble field, which is to say just a trace of extrinsic curvature. And that is not very amenable to taking all the quantity. So this is a formulation which is as geometric as one wants and hopefully can be taken over to quantity.
Okay.
Is there another question here? Gulab, can you come up?
So, why do you sell dual variables here instead of real variables to begin with? I mean, what are the advantages that you get using this variable?
Okay, the advantage are that we can split up the spatial curvature from the extrinsic curvature quite easily in self-dual variables. One forms the real part, the other the imaginary part. And it's just an easier theory to work with in general. We don't have to deal with particularly things like quadratic terms. You can split off the real and imaginary parts quite easily to see where you have cross terms between an extrinsic curvature and a spatial curvature.
Other questions or comments?
Hello, this is Param. I have a comment.
Yeah.
Actually, I would like to comment that a much simpler model than what you are considering shows very similar results in classical GR. That is, if you consider a t equal to 1 homogeneous isotropic system, and if you look for look towards the Big Crunch singularity, but if you have a massive scalar field, so there is a lot of work which was done by Don Page and by Alexey Toporinsky in early 90s, in both in late 80s and then early 90s, and in which they get very similar results. That once you add such a massive scalar, then there are some very special conditions, and you have to do a lot of fine tuning, and then you see these bounces even in the classical GR, and you can avoid singularities. But I think it's something similar which perhaps David reported, that the behavior is very unstable, and perhaps one has to look very carefully what conditions lead actually to the bounce or not. And the other comment is that it's very nice, because in that particular scenario, one definitely had to add a massive scalar to get a bounce in classical GR. Whereas here, that is occurring without any form of matter. But I think that the degrees of freedom are perhaps the same. So maybe it will be useful to look into the literature on that side too, because those guys not only did numerics, and they were able to find analytical solutions also.
Okay, well, I think I should clarify for us. We are not claiming we've shown the bounce in any way whatsoever.
So I think there's a zero order confusion. So let me clarify that before the discussion begins. And that has to do with going to the dictionary maybe and looking for the notes, for the meaning of the word bounce. The word bounce is used completely differently by different communities. So what Parag is talking about is really a bounce which avoids singularity. When people in DKL tend to talk about bounces, singularity is never avoided. Is not avoided singularity at all. The bounce one is talking about is just a sudden transition. As you approach the real singularity, sudden transitions occur from the parameters P1, P2, P3 corresponding to one cardinal epoch to P1 prime, P2 prime, P3 prime corresponding to another cardinal epoch. That is, maybe we should really call it a cardinal bounce. So that is the bounce that one is talking about here. And therefore, at least to the extent I understood, the two issues are quite distinct from each other.
Yeah, so then I think they are quite distinct. Because I thought that even in this case, you are actually getting a bounce from the singularity.
No, not at all.
Okay, thank you.
So this is just classical work, which is going to not at all resolve the singularity. It is understanding how generically fields behave in general relativity, possibly coupled with matter, as one approaches the singularity. Is there a sense in which different distinct spatial points decouple? And the claim is that if the singularity is space-like, this might actually be happening in some precise sense, and that is the DKL conjecture.
Okay, thank you.
Other comments or questions? If not, let us thank David again, and I guess Jorge will let us know about the next seminar. Bye-bye.